Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browder. She's Marjorie Regan. We're continuing our final round with the candidates before Election Day. Here with us in Studio 3 is Seth Moulton. Seth's a Democrat running to represent the 6th Congressional District. His Republican opponent, Richard Tesei, was here yesterday. Seth, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming as well. You know, since you are a veteran and we're in the middle of this mess overseas, you want to talk a little bit about the war, if we can call it the war, that we're engaged in over there. We had your opponent, upcoming Republican Richard Tesei, in here yesterday, and he was saying that if the president proposes ground troops, he'd go with the president. From what I've read about you, and you've been in Iraq 4 times, you're in a different place.
That's right.
Where are you?
I don't think we should use ground troops right now in Iraq, and I'll be happy to explain that. But I also think that it's not Congress's role to simply agree with the president. We have a checks and balances system of government, and Congress ought to ask the toughest questions and demand the highest standards before we put young men and women into harm's way overseas.
I will forget harm's way for a moment. Would you have supported the president's $500 million proposal to arm and train Syrian rebels?
No, I would not.
Why not?
Because I don't think we have a clear enough long-term strategy for making sure that those weapons don't fall into the wrong hands. Don't forget the president said a year and a half ago that we shouldn't arm the moderates in Syria for exactly this reason. And that risk has only worsened today because the moderates in Syria have become marginalized.
But everyone, not everyone, but lots of people back here in the United States are in a low-level panic over ISIS, and they're watching the terrible beheadings, and they're kind of marching right across Iraq and now close to the Turkish border. Should we be there at all?
We absolutely should defeat ISIS. ISIS has killed Americans abroad, and they've made clear their intentions to kill Americans here at home. So our policy should be to defeat ISIS. But in making that declaration, we get to reserve decisions on the timeline and the means to ourselves. And if you look at what happened when ISIS had this dramatic expansion from Syria into western and then northern Iraq, they didn't just defeat the Iraqi army. The Iraqi army put their weapons down and went home because they had lost faith in their government. And so fundamentally, the problem in Iraq today is a political problem. And unless we solve that political problem first, we'll be back solving the military problem for them again.
So let's assume we don't solve the political problem. Let's assume the new prime minister of Iraq is not as inclusionary as he says, unlike al-Maliki, his predecessor. You say we do have to defeat ISIS. Virtually every person, regardless of where they are on the political spectrum, says airstrikes are not enough. What if the Iraqi military never steps up to the plate? What if the alleged moderate Syrian rebels can't pull it together and the Kurd fighters aren't enough? What do we do then?
I'm not going to speculate about what might happen down the road, but I can tell you right now we've got to get the Iraqi military to do its job. And I've worked with these guys. They're not the best army in the world.
What'd you do with them?
I worked with them. I fought alongside them. I trained them. In fact, my mission 10 years ago last month in Iraq as a Marine platoon commander was a military advisory mission. I was on the ground as a military advisor in Iraq. And I can tell you that when the Iraqi unit that we were assigned to train and fight with came under attack from the militia and started to get overrun, we went to their aid, and that started the Battle of Najaf, the worst ground combat of the war until that point. So a military advisory mission can very quickly become ground combat, and we've got to be very careful of that happening in Iraq today. Let's not forget, the Vietnam War started as a military advisory mission.
So should we not have sent the same place? I was just going to say we do have
military advisors over there right now, obviously.
That a mistake too?
That's right. Well, I think it's a mistake insofar as we should make sure we fix the political problem first. Now, the president was absolutely right to deal with the crisis of the Yazidis on the mountain to make sure that a genocide didn't occur. And he's right to beef up the protection of American personnel in Iraq. But we can't just start solving the Iraqis' military problem without conditioning it on political progress, because otherwise we'll be back solving the military problem again for them 2 years from now. I've worked with these guys. They're not the best military in the world, but they outnumber ISIS something like 30-1. They have tanks, artillery, aircraft. There's no reason why these guys shouldn't be able to take care of this problem. And at the end of the day, Iraq has got to be able to defend its own borders and protect its own people.
So when you say they're not the worst military in the world, is this because of the Sunni-Shia split and all the resentments against al-Maliki, the former prime minister? I mean, is that what's wrong with them? Is there something else wrong with them that makes them less than the best military operation around?
Actually, the Iraqi military was one of the most proud institutions in Iraq. It was often able to rise above the sectarian divisions that have come to define the political process in Iraq today. But at the end of the day, if you're going to put your life on the line for your country, you have to have faith in your government. And there's no question that Prime Minister Maliki's government became so sectarian that it started to lose the trust of its people. And I'll tell you, this should not have come as a surprise either. Because when Ambassador Crocker and General Petraeus came back to Congress to report on the surge, they basically said two things. One, the surge has been remarkably successful on the military front. We've made much more progress than we expected. But on the political front, we've not seen as much progress as we need. And so they called for a diplomatic surge. We built the largest embassy in the world, the largest American embassy in the world in Baghdad, but then we left it half full. So we know that the Iraqis need political mentorship. We need to provide it.
I needed a bit of an explainer from you, Seth Moulton, who's the Democrat running in the 6th Congressional District to succeed John Tierney. CNN's headlines this morning were that ISIS controls one-third of Kobani, this town on the border there. What does control mean? I mean, in tangible ways, on the ground, what does it mean to control a third of a major city, even though the United States is poo-pooing it, saying it's not that big a deal, which obviously it is? What does that mean?
It's a great question, because I think that the way CNN is using that term in this article is to say that this military force occupies the city. But that does not mean they control the population. That does not mean they have the support of the population. In fact, when al-Qaeda took over Western Iraq in the 2006-2007 timeframe, initially they were well-liked because they provided some stability and security. They even had a court system. But very quickly, it was clear to the Iraqi people that they were too extreme. One Iraqi told me that, al-Qaeda wouldn't let them walk down the streets holding hands, and then they said they couldn't shave their beards, and it was all over when they said they couldn't smoke. So the point...
That was the final straw.
That was the final straw. But the point is that ISIS has swept across a huge portion of Iraq. That doesn't mean they actually have the allegiance of the people who live in those cities and towns.
We're talking with Seth Moulton, who's running for Congress in the 6th Congressional District. Richard Desai, we had him in yesterday as his Republican opponent. You know, before we leave the war, you kind of two things, actually. We talk about this a lot, Jim and I, about how we wouldn't be so quick to be sending young men and women to war if there were a draft and everybody had, as it were, skin in the game.
No, we didn't say we wouldn't be that quick. We wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah, okay, we wouldn't be doing it. What do you think about a draft?
Well, I think that there are a lot of problems with the military that we had out of a draft. But I am a strong supporter of increased national service opportunities. Now, that doesn't mean that it's mandatory to do national service.
Why not? Why not? I think, why shouldn't, at least, I'm not saying military, why shouldn't there be mandatory service for every high school graduate in America, Seth Moulton?
Well, right now, there's tremendous demand for more service opportunities. So we don't even need to have mandatory service just to try to meet the demand that's out there. Because right now, there are 5 AmeriCorps applicants for every available spot. And I've been working with General McChrystal on national service. In fact, General McChrystal endorsed my campaign, and a lot of people figured it was because we served together in Iraq. Actually, I didn't know him in Iraq. I'd never met him, but I met him back here in America working on national service. We would be a much stronger country if every American felt a civic obligation to serve in some way, not just in the military, but civilian service options as well, places like City Year. General McChrystal envisions a time when if you go into a job interview when you're 30 years old, one of the first questions is, now, where did you serve? I think we'd be a better country if
that
were the
case. But look at Colin Powell. He made a big deal about this, 10 years ago, a volunteer national service thing, and it didn't really get very far.
Well, the new Franklin project that General McChrystal and others are working on, I think, has a lot of potential.
You think so?
Tufts just announced that they are doing national service fellowships. So if you come in as a freshman, you can take a year off before you start to do some sort of national service. So the movement is picking up. And to your point, absolutely, we would be more careful about going to war. I don't think we would have ever gone to Iraq if members of Congress, if a large number of members of Congress had a son or daughter in the military. And I'm not saying that we would just be a pacifist country either. I think we probably would have gone to Afghanistan.
Congress might even be in session to discuss whether we should be doing what we're doing, which would be a nice change.
One more question.
You know, one other thing. We've never had fewer veterans in Congress in our nation's history.
Yeah.
We don't have a single combat veteran representing us in the House or the Senate for Massachusetts. So when we have to address these tough questions about ISIS, about Iran, we ought to have more people there who have the experience, who have been on the ground in the Middle East, and also have the credibility to hold the administration to account.
You know, one other thing before we move into politics, things away from the military, you kind of have an unusual path. I mentioned before we went on the air that there was this great quote from your mother saying that when you decided you were going to be a Marine, she couldn't have, I'm paraphrasing, but the only thing that would have made her more unhappy about your career choice is if you pursued a life of crime, joined the mob or something like that. You also went to Harvard. You don't see a lot of people taking your path from Harvard. So, why? And also, you mentioned the election night. Peter Gomes is one of your mentors, who was the late great chaplain at Harvard University, and wrote beautifully about things spiritual. Why did you choose to be a Marine?
Well, a lot of it does come back to the mentors that I had in college, and especially Reverend Peter Gomes. I took his class. He was quite a professor in addition to being the minister at Harvard, and a moral force on campus. And he talked a lot about the importance of service. How it's not enough just to believe in service or support those who serve. You ought to go find a way to serve yourself. So I looked at different options. I looked at the Peace Corps. I looked at teaching overseas. But at the end of the day, I had so much respect for the 18 and 19-year-old kids who put their lives on the line for our country that I decided that that's where I wanted to serve myself. Now, I had no idea that I'd be getting into a war. I graduated in June of 2001. So September 11th happened 3 months later, and my training started shortly after that, and before I knew it, I was on the front lines in the first company of Marines into Baghdad.
Okay, so I have the unenviable task, Seth Moulton, of moving from the spiritual to back to politics at home. You've taken criticism on a couple of fronts this week. One, you canceled a debate here tonight with Emily Rooney's show, so that you do a fundraiser with Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the chair of the DNC. And secondly, you've been criticized for raising a ton of your money leading up to the primary, not amongst your constituents, but out of state, Wall Street, et cetera, 60-some percent out of state. Guilty on both counts or no?
Look, we have six debates in this race. In the short time between September 9th and the general election on November 4th, the presidential candidates are able to get by with three. I think six is enough. I felt bad that we couldn't make the schedule work, and I'd love to be on the show again. But you know, that's just the reality of having an incredibly tight schedule.
How about the out-of-state money?
Look, I've been humbled by the support that we've received from this race from around the country. The majority of our events are in the district. But I think that this story of a young, pragmatic veteran taking on a career politician, both in the primary and now again in the general, is resonating with people far and wide. And I've been surprised and also humbled by the number of folks who recognize this is an important race, not just here in Massachusetts, but beyond our borders.
Is that kind of split going to continue in your post-primary leading up to final when the reports come out for how much you raised post whatever the primary day was leading up to November 4th? Is it still going to be a majority of the money from out of state?
I'm not sure. We get literally hundreds of contributions.
But what do you think? But
I would imagine that the national interest is still there. I mean, there's certainly been a lot of national attention paid to this race in the press.
Speaking of national interest, the good news and the bad news, sort of the best times, worst times, I guess. Michael Bloomberg, a local kid, and then made $1 billion and moved out of town. A kid from Medford, obviously the former mayor of New York, Democrat, Republican, then independent, endorsed your candidacy the other day. But at least as of a day or two ago, the two people who ran against you, John Tierney, you ran against him, I guess. He was the incumbent. And Marisa DeFranco, who also ran the Democratic primary, have not endorsed you. Why? What does that say about the support for your candidacy amongst whomever back home?
Well, what I'm finding from voters in the district is that people are really rallying to my candidacy. And the day after the election, that morning at 7 a.m., I was down meeting voters at the train station in Salem on my way to Boston. And I met a lot of voters who supported me in the primary, but I also met a lot of voters who supported the congressman or Marisa or other candidates. And what I found is that they wanted to meet me and they wanted to know what I was all about, but they're very quickly rallying to the cause.
Why haven't they supported you, though? I mean, it's been a while. Was it a month or at least a couple of weeks since the primary? Why haven't it? Well, Tierney in particular, When the democratic infrastructure, even though I'm told you were treated actually fairly shabbily at that unity breakfast, that you had to wait and wait and wait.
Would you wait an hour and a half or something like that, an hour and 45 minutes?
He won't say that. But in any case,
he's
smiling, half smiling.
He was over there with the people that lost, the bottom line.
But Seth, why isn't Tierney, if the rest of the infrastructure, almost all of whom endorsed Tierney, have said Seth is now our guy, what's the Tierney issue?
I can't speak for the congressman.
Have you spoken to him?
I've reached out to him several times.
And he hasn't called you back?
We look forward to speaking.
He hasn't called – you have not spoken to Tierney since the election?
Not yet. But what I have found is that the Democratic establishment that admittedly was aligned against me in this primary has very quickly rallied to my side, not just in Massachusetts. Senator Tom McGee, the chairman of the state party, and others have been wonderful in working to really bring – not just reaching out to me individually, but working to bring Democrats together, but also at the national level in Washington, D.C. They've really rallied behind my campaign. So I've been thrilled with that support.
You know, one thing that is very attractive, I think, to some voters is that we don't have any Republicans in our delegation. It is a Democratic delegation all the way through. Almost everybody votes the same way all the time. How do you counter that? I mean, are you, you know, to say as a Republican, are you going to be, as he's accused, like just another kind of rubber stamp for all the Democratic agendas? And why should people believe you might be any different?
Absolutely not. If I did what all the Democrats wanted me to do, I would never have even entered this race. So from the very beginning, I've been willing to go against the establishment. I'm someone who proudly fought in a war that I disagreed with. So I have no concerns about my ability to take an independent stance on the issues. But the reality is that today in Washington, the Republican agenda in the majority is being controlled by the far right. And we can't add anything more to that majority. We can't strengthen that majority that's tried to shut down the government, that's fought against health care, that fights regularly against women's rights and gay rights. We can't strengthen
but
that majority.
You could argue that Desai would be throwing strength to the other side because he's a moderate Republican and certainly you could say almost liberal on social issues.
No, he's not going to. He said his first vote is for John Boehner as Speaker of the House. So he's absolutely going to be party to that agenda. And the idea that a freshman Republican from Massachusetts who can stand up to the Tea Party extremists is just not true. I mean, John Boehner himself tried to prevent the Tea Party coalition from shutting down the government, and he wasn't able to do that.
Yeah, Seth, speaking of Michael Bloomberg, we're talking to Seth Moulton, who's the Democratic candidate in the 6th Congressional District. Michael Bloomberg, I read part of what he said, and part of what he said, correct me if I'm wrong, is because you can reach across the aisle, that sort of thing. And I think the average voter, I'd say 90% of them, and that's just my guess, want bipartisanship. They're sick of the dysfunction. Give me an issue or two, despite, as you said a second ago, excoriating some of the more conservative elements of the Republican Party in the House. They'll have the majority if you're elected. Give me an issue or two where you would reach across the aisle and be willing to embrace their worldview on something so that something happened as opposed to a gridlock, which is what we live with for years.
Well, it's a great question because you're absolutely right. This is what voters want. Voters want people who can work across the aisle, and that's the premise of Mayor Bloomberg's endorsement, is he endorsed 10 candidates across the country who have the ability to work across the aisle. And he could very well have chosen Richard Desai, but I'm proud that he chose me for that ability.
So what's the issue that you could reach across the aisle on that would be hard, not an easy one, a hard one?
Well, I think one very difficult issue is corporate tax reform. And most Democrats think that we ought to close corporate tax loopholes because right now the biggest corporations in America often pay the lowest tax rates, and that's not fair to small businesses. But at the same time, a lot of Republicans think that we should lower corporate tax rates. Well, I think most Americans agree that there's this healthy compromise in the middle where if we were effectively able to close those loopholes, we could lower the corporate tax rate and make America more competitive.
Did you ever vote for a Republican?
I never have, but you know, I always try to vote on the person.
Can I ask you one last thing from me, and then, or do you want to go? One last thing.
Okay, real quick, and then I have a real quick one too.
You mentioned a minute ago, and I've heard you say it before. You know, I fought in a war. You did four tours, if I remember, that I disagreed with. Late at night, some nights, you're over there, and you're saying to yourself, "I don't agree with this thing. I'm putting myself at risk every day." I hate to say briefly, but briefly, how do you deal with that contradiction, for lack of a better expression?
I think it's hard, I never wanted someone else to be there in my place. And that doesn't make me a hero. That just makes me any U.S. veteran. That's what any veteran would tell you. And that's why I kept going back, so that I could serve with the guys who I knew were over there. But the other thing I found is that being there on the ground in Iraq, I had a tremendous influence on the way the war was fought. And I worked hard every single day to save as many lives as I could, American and Iraqi. And I think I had more influence on this difficult war that I disagreed with being there on the ground than I would have had back here in America.
This has got to be a really quick answer because we are almost out of time here, practically out of time. A lot of us are confused about whom to believe on this war. You hear all these generals on television, you hear everybody talking. Is there you're a smart guy, obviously. Is there a thinker on this war that you think has more credibility than others that we might look to when we're seeking to form our own opinions of what we should be doing?
Well, I certainly think that General Petraeus and General McChrystal, who are two of my mentors, are incredibly thoughtful on the war. I had lunch with General Petraeus just a couple days ago and talked a lot about ISIS and what to do. And he is a very, I think, wise man who has a tremendous amount of on-the-ground experience. But I tell you, when I want to know what's going on, yeah. I talk to them. I also talk to my Iraqi friends. I talk to friends in the Middle East to understand what's going on the ground. And I think that having that breadth of experience will be important in Congress.
What's your website, Seth?
SethMoulton.com.
Great to see you.
Thank you very much for coming in, Seth. Seth Moulton is a Democratic congressional candidate. He is running to represent the 6th District. Thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Please tune in tomorrow at 11 o'clock. We've got a bunch of stuff. Charlie Baker, who's running for governor, is going to be with us in studio. Emily Rooney's world-famous list and, of course, our soon-to-be world-famous news quiz. Our show is a production of WGBH. Our team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, Catherine Whalen, and our engineer, John Parker. I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm still upset about that fourth scientist who doesn't get the Nobel Prize. I can't get over that. I am Jim Browdy.
Yeah, you are Jim Browdy. I'm upset about the 52% of the animals that are
disappearing.
You should
be. We'll see you tomorrow.
Okay. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow, I hope.